I wonder a little if the reflections before lunch led to any further reflections for yourselves during that period, since we have this as a theme for the day, compassion in action, which is really pointing to the engagement of that compassionate response that I think very natural and very central in terms of centrally definitive of what it means to be truly human. That central response of the wish to relieve, to end, to heal, to cure, to transform, to release suffering in its different forms, in the ways we encounter it in ourselves, in our communities, in our world. This is something, I think, as I mentioned at the beginning of the day, very much at the heart of the Buddha's teaching and his own compassionate wish to relieve the suffering of beings, offering the teachings that he gave. And in the teachings, we understand this movement of compassion as that wish to relieve suffering, as the expression of kindness, of care, of friendliness, of love, when it's in contact with that situation, circumstance, person, or part of oneself where there is suffering. So that quality of caring, of love, of kindness, when it encounters suffering, is the natural wish to relieve the suffering. And I think this is something that we're familiar with. We can understand that from our own experience. Of course, sometimes it's difficult for us to really let it in because we may feel there isn't something we can do to release or to relieve or to transform the suffering. And therefore it feels almost too painful to allow ourselves to be touched by it, to be impacted by it. And yet it seems to me essential that we do find ways to allow ourselves to be touched. Because without that touch, there isn't really the capacity to respond. We might do things out of an idea of what I should, to be good or kind or charitable or helpful or even a good Buddhist, Catholic, Jew, Hindu, whoever religious tradition we might get our being good from, or good humanist, good Quaker. Apologies to the Quakers, they're actually really good as far as I can tell, in terms of that engagement with the world and wishing to bring about an end to suffering where it's encountered. So it's actually lovely just even to see in the context of this day, as I always enjoy to be here in the Cambridge Quaker Centre, but also at other Quaker centres where I sometimes find myself teaching in this way. There's a very clear articulation of the concern for the well-being of others and the wish to not just be concerned, but to act on that concern. So engaging in meditation is an inner expression of that action, of that process of seeing actually there's a suffering involved in being out of touch with ourselves. There's a profound suffering we experience in not being intimate ourselves, our inner experience. And by self, in that I'm not meaning some kind of construct of ego, but about the intimate experience that's happening here. That's different than the intimate experience happening there. And I'm not pointing to any of you because I don't know what your experience is in this moment, but I could equally be pointing to each of you individually. It's like, oh yeah, there's something that's happening here, which we can, for general purposes, refer to as my experience. Now, at one level, it's simply experience unfolding. That's true. But that doesn't take away the wish and the natural wish within that, that when suffering is the experience simply unfolding, that there be equally unfolding the wish to address it, to respond to it, to transform it. So when we reflect on, when we open to, when we allow ourselves to just let in the suffering of the world, it's something very powerful for us. It's actually a practice in itself. I find it something important and powerful for myself to, on a regular basis, just really take some time to contemplate some of the things I know about that are happening in the world. And I don't watch the news very much because I don't find that's a useful way to do it. It's a kind of a sensationalized, this is the story of the moment version that actually doesn't have the effect of connecting us with what's going on. Kind of, interestingly, more often I experience it as a distancing, which is sometimes contemplating. You know, today, just now, having lunch. And I often, when we have a day like this, I try and remember to say something like, you know, we're fortunate to have some food to eat, because probably all of us do. And we know, all of us know also, that not everybody has that. I ate about half of the food that was so kindly prepared for me by Jackie here, and, you know, sort of like, wow, it's a bountiful situation. And I spent a little time just contemplating the fact that I read this first in a book by Thich Nhat Hanh, but I researched and checked it, and there's various versions of the number, but the number is approximately 40,000 children who die every day for not having enough food or clean water. Not in a world where there isn't enough food. 40,000 children die. And I try and think, how many children is that? There's not even 40 of us. 40 of us in here. How many children is 40,000? I can't quite get my head around that number, but I know it's a lot more than what I can actually just wrap my consciousness around in one moment, in one go. And every day. Yesterday. Today. Tomorrow. And in some ways, the food is there, it's just not in the right place, or it's not given by those who have it to those who don't. It's quite simple. The means are there for that to happen, and yet it doesn't, because the means in the human heart are not there. It's not about an absence of food or the means to transport it. It's about something in the human heart that's closed down, tragically, to the suffering. Born out of fear, generally. People hold on to things, and I do it too, because they're afraid if we don't, we won't have enough. And what if we give it all away? Then they'll have it, and we'll be the ones hungry. Don't want to do that. But that's all in a way, that's sort of froth a little bit, isn't it? You can see, I'm kind of wanting to articulate it. That's what goes on for me with that a bit. You know, and I'm doing my best to reduce consumption. I'm doing what I can to support charities and things. But actually just letting it in. Oh, 40,000 children today. That's just one of the territories. And one small, in a way, large, small fact. What happens for us? I think it's very easy to almost like start to withdraw. I've got enough trouble going on in my life. I don't need to bring that in. You know, we can feel that. It's a sort of a, just a moment, that's a little bit too much. And yet there's something I think, it's a different kind of exercise than the meditative exercise that we're engaged in of coming back to the breath, coming back to the moment, coming back to the body. There's something in that that's not easy. We keep bouncing off, we keep going away. And it's a process, a practice, to come back to being present. But equally, it's a process and a practice to just bring us back to something like the contemplation of that particular fact I just offered. Something to just see, how does that land? How does that resonate to us? Now again, there's another probably often quoted, maybe well-known thing, and I just checked it again to see what the latest version of it is, which is much the same as what I knew, that at the moment there's an area the size of Texas. Texas, which I guess the whole UK and New Zealand would fit into one small corner of. The size of Texas in the North Pacific Ocean of plastic, bags, bottles and items. It's like this vast amount of non-degradable material that's not just sitting there, but actually poisoning fish, choking dolphins, messing up the ecosystem. It's the size of Texas. And it's not getting smaller. And whenever we take a plastic bag or unwrap a plastic thing, we're part of it. Now, I'm not wanting to say that to make anyone feel bad here, because I don't know that it's about self-blame at all. I don't think so. But in this world, what is it to open ourselves up to the condition of how it is? If we don't and can't open ourselves to let ourselves feel our own pain, with compassion, with kindness, for the fact that actually it hurts me. It really hurts to let it be known that this is so in this world. And that for all that I might have tried to do things to reduce or ameliorate those kind of impacts, I still contribute to them in perhaps a smaller way than someone else who doesn't even know about it or give a toss or appear to give a toss. But I contribute to them. There's something for me that's really important about sitting and contemplating that. Just thinking about it. What is that for me? What is that like? Because what I find is, and not just that that's difficult and painful at times, but there's something healing about allowing myself to really make contact with the truth of that. It's like saying, yes, I'm not looking at that from some distance. Although I sort of am. I'm part of and one of the beneficiaries of a system that produces that outcome. I'd rather it didn't happen. If I could stop it by pushing a button on my left right now, I would. But I don't have that option. That's my right, isn't it? Anyway. It's like, oh, I'm part of a system that produces this. Now, in a more immediate sense, I equally have a responsibility for the system that's going on in here that produces my own reactivity, aggression, greed or neediness, spacing out tendencies and delusional behaviours. They happen in the microcosm of our inner experience equally as they play out in the world. So what is it in terms of compassion to take responsibility? Because this, I think, is the question. One element of taking responsibility, and a central element for me, and you know, within Buddhist practice and teaching, and I think the broader realm of spiritual practice, is inner work, because we're taking care of the roots, the tendencies in the human mind that create those situations. That's how they come to be. The tendencies of greed and of fear and of blindness. That's how the conditions of the world come to be. What we see in the world is the playing out of human patterning. And those are patterns which can be understood and changed, transformed. This was part of the remarkable teaching of the Buddha, that we can understand the forces that drive us in such a way as to free ourselves from them, to be no longer driven by them, and therefore to free, to allow the more core or central movement of our humanity to express itself in terms of kindness, in terms of compassion. For myself, as a young man, I was profoundly distressed and confused to see what was going on in the world, and equally in myself, in terms of the behaviors that clearly were causing harm, that was obvious it was harmful, but which were being continued. And you know, whether, and, you know, then for me, I remember very easy to focus on, you know, national governmental organizations or corporations and, you know, all of them out there doing those bad things. And then seeing that actually, yeah, me too, I'm scared to lose what I have. In fact, I'd quite like to have a bit more than I've got, even though I've got quite a bit. I'd really like a bit more. It would feel comfortable or safe. It's not so different. It's not so different. I'm just less successful than some large organizations that are accumulating lots of material things and managing to sort of, shall we say, push aside or possibly squash the things that and beings that have gotten in the way. It's like it's really interesting for me when I talk about that precept at the beginning of the day of not harming other beings. And it's not easy for us sometimes when little beings get into our homes and start to eat the wood, you know, eat the foundations or whatever, or they get into our clothes and start to eat our bodies. We don't like that. I don't like that. But when we just say, oh, I'm going to squash them, we're not acting that differently than a large nation state or corporation that says, well, this group of people or activity is in the way of my comfort and profit, and I'll just kind of remove them, whether kindly to another place or less kindly by more literally squashing them. Those tendencies are in us. And yet, probably for most of us, and I'm sure for the people in charge of those kind of big organizations and powerful things, that's not what they really want to be coming from or believe is the most important thing. But often, don't feel there's any other choice. So I want to kind of lay that out a little bit as I have, because I think one of the strongest things that actually inhibits our ability to really engage compassionately with life is the judgment and anger we have towards all the causes of the suffering. Which, whether we blame ourselves or whether we blame another, that anger and judgment doesn't really help. What's needed is a willingness. Anger and judgment are mechanisms for actually pushing away and distancing the suffering. By blaming it on someone else, and if they didn't do it, or some part of me, if I didn't do it, it wouldn't happen. So this invitation, it's probably not a particularly, you know, enthusing, or not one we would enthuse about being offered, to actually let ourselves really feel and contemplate the suffering of this world. You know, in the Mahayana, northern, later Buddhist tradition, the image of Kuan Yin and Avalokiteshvara, who sort of described as listening to the sounds or the cries of the universe, that willingness to actually hear, and this is the embodiment of compassion, to listen to the cries of the universe, to actually hear, to feel, to resonate with the suffering that is here. Without saying it's your fault or my fault or their fault, but seeing quite free of conceiving of fault, because there are so many conditions that give rise to all this. What is my responsibility? And responsibility is clearly in terms of what is our ability to respond. That's what the word means. So compassion in action is about really asking ourselves, what's my ability to respond? And then within that ability, not beyond it, but nor less than it, doing what we can. So one of the abilities we have is to give some space and support and in a way invite some healing to our hearts and minds just by allowing their cries, so to speak, to be heard, listening to the cries of the universe. Some of them are happening in here, for sure. Some of them are happening, and I'm not going to point to any of you, but in the location that you guys, each of you, are sitting in also. And to listen to that, to actually start to feel it. When we don't listen to it, when we think it's a sign there's something wrong with me or the world, what we tend to do is reject it. And in that rejection, there's an isolation, there's a separation, there's a cutting off and a disconnection that tends to be, you know, us and them, or sometimes me and it, which is the part of me that I really think is the problem. And we relate to it kind of like, sort of me, but sort of it, but separate. That's the effect of judgment and aversion, rejection, that pushing away. When we actually see, oh, this is suffering, there's suffering here, there's suffering there, there's suffering in so many ways and places we can look. When we actually look at that and let ourselves be touched by that, rather than separating us, it connects us. Rather than separating us, it connects us. You know, the older and well-known sort of, I guess, I don't know if it's even Western, but certainly in our culture, the sort of that statement of a problem shared is a problem halved. You know, it's like if we actually talk about our suffering with somebody else, it's not quite so hard to bear. It's such a well-known thing. I recently saw the movie made about the, not so much the whole life, but the period of life of the person, one of the two people primarily involved with the founding of the Alcoholics Anonymous movement and his journey into that, and the discovery, almost by accident, that it was by talking with someone else who was also an addict whose life was also blighted by alcohol, and talking, and they discovered that talking was actually what helped them. That's what got them through it. And the very interesting thing that they weren't trying to help the other person by doing it, they were trying to help themselves. I need your help, was the phrase, rather I'm going to help you. That actually shifted things. But that sense of what is so powerfully transformative for us about sharing suffering is that it breaks down the barrier and the boundary that both is actually the deepest level of the suffering itself, but also paralyzes or limits us or disconnects us from our natural ability and the natural responsivity of our hearts to engage, to respond, to find something that we can do. So it's not to get rid of the suffering in the world. Or not because we reject it as wrong or bad, but because, in fact, our humanity, what's true about a human being, inevitably and unstoppably wishes for the end of this. There's something true about that. There's something right about it, which is at the heart of the spiritual journey. That we realize there's some potential for more freedom, well-being, happiness, mutuality in the world, equally as in ourselves. There's a beautiful line from Zen monk Ryokan, who lived in the 17th, 18th century. And he's a wonderful poet. And he, one of his phrases really captures this sort of this wish. He said once, "Oh, that my monk's robe was wide enough to gather up all the beings in this, all the suffering beings in this floating world." And just that sense of that wish to just, you know, in a way, gather up, I guess, you know, bring into his heart, wrap his robe, his monk's robe, around all the suffering beings in this floating world, this world of things that aren't for sure, that aren't reliable, that we can sometimes find ourselves floating on and sometimes find ourselves flailing in. Because it's fluid, it's dynamic, it's not in our control, it's not reliable. It's the nature of it. It's a floating world, a fleeting world, a fluid world. And we so wish to be held within that, to find ways to hold ourselves. Ryokan, he wrote some very, very, for me, beautiful poetry in the solitude of his hermitage. There are many stories told about him. He's one of my favorite teachers that I never met. But there's one story that's probably my favorite of his, and some of you will have heard me say it before, but apropos of what I was saying about irritating creatures, he was once seen on a cold winter's morning after a frost, picking the lice out of his robe and putting them on a sunward facing stone to warm themselves up in the bright sunshine. And it's remarkable, sort of compassionate, careful, putting them there in the sun where they'd be nice and warm. And at the end of the day, even more remarkable, picking them up and putting them back in his robe. And I've often found myself contemplating, what was in that guy's heart? How had he understood this teaching, this life, that would let him, it seems, joyfully do that? Something beautiful, something inspiring, and yet, of course, very simple. Not saying that that's necessarily what our path will be, how we have to express that. I'm quite aware, speaking in some of the ways I have here, that it's in a certain way a smallish container for the territory to have a day, to invite you to actually touch into things that might not be easy to touch, to feel, and to really be respectful for yourself for how far it feels okay for you. I certainly have no expectation that this take any one of us here any further than it organically does without any forcing or pushing. To actually give our life permission to find its way here is really important. It's very easy to come in with a sense of I should, I must, and he's telling me I've got to, and if I haven't, I'm no good, and surely I should have done some more by now, and by tomorrow I better have, you know. That's not usually a very helpful response. For myself, what I've found is to just let the felt sense of the experience settle more deeply into the heart and see what comes. See what comes. It's like allowing ourselves to know the suffering in a situation, whether personal, in our communities, families, relationships, workplaces, or in the global arena. Allowing ourselves to let it in. And then trust what comes back, trust what flows out of that. There's something about the truth that informs us and allows us to respond And how that response looks can't be judged from the outside. Or how it looks is not the most important thing, and how it looks from the outside. It's more that we allow ourselves to respond. And so if someone's distressed and we just say, I'm sorry to hear you're distressed, and there's nothing we can do to help them, to let ourselves say it. Sometimes we might hold back from saying anything because it's too horrific to even contemplate. But yet there's something so important, and we know this. I'm not telling you things you don't know, I'm sure. We know this, just that someone acknowledges, wow, that's difficult. What a situation to be in. Whether it be a situation we've been in before, or one we can't contemplate what that would be like. The woman I spoke about whose son was murdered, it's like, I can't conceive what that would be like. But I can tell that it would be really, really hard. And that she could find actually in her heart compassion for the murderer, for the circumstances of that person's life that led him to that. Wow, amazing. The capacity of the human heart is incredible. Incredible. And sometimes what we have to really understand in this territory is that we hit our own limitations. And what's needed is compassion for ourselves and our own limitations. When I was first traveling in Asia, quite a long time ago now, and that was the first time I'd been in the third world, and in fact, particularly in India, so much poverty, and I'm quarter Indian, my grandmother is Bengali, my mother was born in Calcutta. And in that city, so much poverty, so much distress and disease and, you know, desperate circumstances that so many people live in. And I was there, you know, in a certain way, young and bright and very sort of optimistic about life and idealistic about life. And I realized that actually I wanted to give all the money I'd saved up. I worked for 2 whole years after university. It was hard to work for that long. That was probably now the sum total of my proper work career in my life. But at that point, I thought probably I'll go back to something like that at some point. And I thought I could give everything I've got to some charity or organization or group helping these people, go back home 2 years or less, I'd have it again, I could do this whole trip. It wouldn't limit my life at all. And it was incredibly sobering and painful to see I couldn't do it. I could not. I gave some and I tried to help and got involved in some various charitable organizations working there. But I couldn't give away what I had. I was way too attached to it. And just to sit and feel that and have to be honest with myself. Me too. Yes, member of the human race. And where we find the bar where we draw the line that says that's as much as I give and I can't give more than that. Of course, that looks different for each of us. But it's also really clear to me that the higher we place that bar, the more we need to have to feel comfortable, that's in direct proportion to the amount of suffering that's going on around neediness and fear and insecurity. And so where someone, I can't understand how they can be happy to have so much more than me, I kind of have some understanding. Oh, there's suffering in that. Or just the suffering of not allowing oneself to know that others have got so little. And so with that, one of the things I came to understand that I wanted to speak of here, it's like it's really important that we're compassionate with ourselves, but that we do what we can. We do what we can in this world. There are so many things we can do. There are so many ways we can act. And I trust and am confident that for many of you there are those expressions already. And I'm not sort of saying this out of any anticipation that you're not doing that. And yet, it's also very easy to not quite trust our capacity to let it in. Life. And that dimension of life which is difficult. Of course, I'm not saying that's all there is to life. There's, of course, beauty and joy and nobility and many wonderful things that we equally need to let in fully, that evoke a different response that's more uplifted and joyful. But in fact, the response that comes to, or the effect of responding where we can, doing what we can, is equally something profoundly uplifting. So compassion isn't always about self-sacrifice. It's not about denying our own needs, but about not ignoring others or ourselves. In terms of the Dharma teachings, one of the fundamental understandings that we're being pointed to the exploration and the understanding of is how it is we conceive ourselves as being separate from, apart from, distant from others or the world, whether other beings, other species, the very natural environment. If we look, if we contemplate, if we reflect even just upon the very air that we breathe and our moment-to-moment dependence upon the trees around us and the grasses to provide that oxygen. If we contemplate this, we see we cannot exist separately. And we do not exist separately. It's a fiction in our minds. And to take care of only part of the whole, at some level is a, it's kind of, how to say this, when we don't allow ourselves to open to include all that's out there that is part of what we are part of, it's like there's a, say a wound we carry or a breach in our heart is perhaps a better word for it. There's a breach in the heart that really underpins so much of the suffering that goes on in the world. The sense of a not knowing what's true of our interconnectedness and our non-separateness from each other. And living in a life in which that caring, that love, that kindness, that compassion that is inherent is nonetheless, in a way, kind of profoundly limited in its expression because we have become identified with ways of seeing the world that limit our sense of care and responsibility for it. Because we've separated ourselves from those parts that we're not feeling, therefore obliged to care for. There isn't ultimately anything inside or outside in terms of what we really are. There's just this. And some of it we could say is over here, and some of it's over there. But it's just this. And there isn't something else. And within that, there's this movement of responsivity, the ability to respond, the capacity to respond. And it's my belief and my experience that it's for our own deepest well-being that we allow this more and more full expression into the world. Our individual and we could say personal well-being, and equally of course for the well-being of life and all of us together. So another story I'd like to share from that early time when I was in India. I'd really just begun my meditation practice, didn't have any spiritual credentials, not that I necessarily do now, but somehow I think people perhaps see me because of my role in a particular way, but certainly then and really now too, I was just stumbling along, as we do. And on this particular version of stumbling along, I was in Calcutta with a friend and we went to visit one of the institutions that had been established by the Order of or Mother Teresa and her Order, the Sisters of Mercy or Charity, I can't remember now the name of the organization. It was an orphanage, and in Calcutta there were many, many young babies and young children who either their parents are dying, ill, or dead. or whose parents just have no resources to be able to provide for them and no education to prevent themselves continuously producing more babies. And so a lot of very young babies and children in this orphanage, and not many resources to support. My friend and I went to visit, called Shishu Bhavan, which translates Shishi as children, Bhavan, home, children's home. And first of all, we were told before we got there that men, just as a cultural, some probably good reason for it, but culturally in that cultural context, men aren't allowed to work with babies and young children, just not permissible, not allowed, not culturally acceptable. So we could make a visit of a couple of hours, but that was it. We couldn't volunteer there or work there in ways we could at other places. We went, and the first thing that we encountered was this group of young boys who really didn't get to have much contact with men. And because all the women working there were mostly the nuns of the order. And it was very, very just all this bright, uncle, because that's, you're always a relation in India with anybody. And it was very delightful, very, very lovely initial just contact with these. But we wanted to go into the section because we knew that there was a lot of babies here. Just wanting to. And so we were shown to the room where the babies were. And it was a room probably twice the size of this room, possibly a little bit larger. And it was full of cots, and the cots were sort of packed together with room for a person to walk between them, so the aisles every way, but all these cots. And in each cot, two babies. And in the room, maybe three nuns, I think. Some of them, a couple of them maybe with bottles, and a couple of them, so maybe there was four, a couple of them with sort of buckets and sponges. And very quickly, what we saw was that they were feeding them, or they were cleaning the babies. And the babies, as we walked into the room, they started looking up at us. And the slightly older ones started pulling us up on the side of the cot and reaching out to us. And my friend and I, we just turned to each other, and instantly we both knew the situation here. There was this room full of dozens and dozens of babies. And the women looking after, the nuns looking after them, had enough time to rush around that room all day, feeding them and cleaning them. But not really much time beyond that. And these babies wanted to be held. So we realized this, and we just reached out, picking up a baby, and it was like putting, like a limpet, sort of, they knew what they wanted to hold someone. And we're just holding this baby for a little while. And it was so sweet, and just, they just, oh. And then after a while, there's this room full of babies, so just, peeling this baby off, it didn't want to go, putting it down, picking up another one. We were there for 2 hours. We didn't get round even half the babies in the room. It was heartbreaking, and there was something profoundly healing about doing what we could, which was just that. It occurred to me at that time, and I believe it was a truthful understanding, that I could spend my whole life in that room doing just that, and there isn't another more fulfilling life I could imagine that would be more meaningful than just doing that. That's not how my life worked out. But something that, the thing that really impacted me most was the sense, first of all, of hopelessness. Oh my gosh, how much need is there? I can't meet this. And then through the process of just doing what we could, which was spending 2 hours with as many of them as we could, was just making that, holding contact. And then we left, and I've never been back. But something in me is still there. Something of that still with me. And every time I talk about it, I feel it. And there's ways in which we can do this in the world where we just do what we can with situations. We just do what we can with circumstances. Where we give a little support to an organization that's doing some good work. Or we extend a kind word to someone in trouble. Or we offer some help to someone need some help. Or we do something that's a little uncomfortable, or not necessarily uncomfortable, that means we're not as comfortable as we'd like to be in order to reduce our impact on the world. There's so many ways we can do that. And you know, it's a quicker path to happiness than getting comfortable. I don't mean that as some kind of glib line. The urge and the drivenness of the self, of the ego, of the personality structure to try and get permanently and reliably comfortable never actually comes to fulfillment and leads to an incredible amount of frustration along the way. I'm not saying we have to seek discomfort. There's something deeper that brings the happiness and the inner peace that we seek. And I'd like to say it was just calming your mind, but I don't think it is. It's bad coming from a meditation teacher, I know. It's not been my experience. Calming the mind is lovely. But it's only for a while and in very particular circumstances. Calming the heart, now that's something else. That comes from allowing it to be touched and to respond. Allowing it to be touched, because actually our hearts want to be touched by this world. And grieve the distance that we hold it at sometimes. And our hearts need to respond, because it's their life, it's their aliveness. That if we don't allow them to be touched, they can't, and they don't. And then we go looking for satisfaction in things, in circumstances, in external possessions or comforts, or even relationships and all of that, which have their place and their value and their importance, but don't ultimately meet that deepest place in what we are. So let's take a little time for some walking meditation, which if you feel so moved, to include some just reflection and contemplation upon the themes that I've been reflecting upon, or your own responses to them, which may be anything that they may be. Just to let yourself have a bit of time. And in that way then, to not be trying too hard to be very mindfully concentrating on every momentary micro sensation of the footfall, but more just the sense of what it is to be in this world and to move with sensitivity, with mindfulness, but equally with a kind of an attunement to the reality that we live in. We live in a blessed time and circumstance, all of us, for all that. Many of you, I'm sure, have really difficult things in your lives. Certainly I do. And at the same time, we have remarkable capacity and access to remarkable resources in ourselves and around us. Even just that there are, I'm guessing, 30-something people who are interested to come and spend a day of their weekend, of their precious free time, sitting around doing nothing useful, producing nothing they can sell in the market, and contemplating the territory of compassion. I mean, there's something profoundly precious in just acknowledging that and seeing that that's part of what's true too. And not just here, but in many places around the world, people such as us equally care deeply about our own lives and about each other in this world. So whatever of that resonates with you, let it percolate. And whatever if it doesn't, let it do what it does. We'll take 20 minutes now for some walking meditation. So it's 25 minutes by both of our watches. I think I changed mine. 25 minutes past 3. And if we come back in again at 4:15, we'll have a sitting together then.